Accession number 31408.
John Shoebridge, reel 4.
Can we stop in the middle of a reel or not?
Absolutely, not a problem. Not a problem. Okay.
So after Arbroath, now then, we then went on a short leave, and we were waiting to be appointed somewhere. It could have been straight to a frontline squadron, torpedo or anti-submarine of some sort or another, one of the big carriers. We no idea, one of the escort carriers. You know the escort carriers, they were the ones down from the big fleets. And then you had the Mack ships and the very smallest ones of all. I was sent to a very nice 8 weeks odd at Naval Air Station St Merrin, which is the first time I'd been in Cornwall in my life, and that was near Padstow, as you might know. Flying swordfish, training air gunners.
And this, I just think we're now, I want to get the time.
This right. is now, this Please. Is now.
Early summer 43.
This is the early summer 43. In fact, I'm turning my logbook over at the moment, and I'm just coming on to 774 Squadron. Here we are. March the 26th. Yeah, there we are. March the 26th, first flight from RNAS St Merrin in 774 Squadron, training the air gunners to fire their guns properly. We used to fly from St Merrin over the Bristol Channel, go up and down. One of us would be flying a drogue behind our swordfish. The other one would have an air gunner in the back, would go past the drogue and would pepper the drogue, hopefully. And that's what we did there. And that was a very pleasant number. It turned out to be a very fine couple of months down there from weather-wise point of view. The Ring of Bells at St Cullum Minor, I remember well, was a splendid pub, as was the Cornish Arms at St Merrin itself. We flew quite a lot, really, but it was pleasant flying in nice weather.
It was warm, and you were accommodated under canvas again, or
were you? No, we'd been in Arbroath, was a peacetime war station, air station, as was St Merrin as well, as had been Crail. So we were all in twin cabins. Oh, great luxury, oh, indeed we were, oh yes. Oh no, bathrooms and all that sort of thing. Well, not our own bathroom, but no. Very nice indeed it was at St Merrin.
Cornwall in wartime, it was.
Well, the food wasn't quite as strict, I suspect. Little did I know I was going to be 42 years I've lived in this bungalow after the war. And I left, I see here, in. Wait a minute, where are we now? Oh, I spent a little longer than I thought there. Oh, I left in May the 25th. So I had getting on for two whole months at St Merrin. Very nice indeed.
And you were training gunners?
Training air gunners, pure and simple.
So you weren't actually training them, of course, you were just flying the planes.
We were flying the planes, yeah, that's right.
And there was a gunner, and was there a trainer with
the gunner? Would be, I believe, if I recall rightly, there would be somebody with the air gunner in the aeroplane, yes, there would.
So it would be the first time that you've flown the plane with other people in it, really, more or less?
More or less, yes, other than as a passenger, maybe, yes, somewhere. Yeah, it would indeed.
And you'd communicate by a speaking tube, was that correct?
That's right, Swordfish had a speaking tube, yeah.
Which worked?
It worked. Not as well as a modern RT does. No, of course not. But it worked. It worked. It was all right.
I can't quite envision. You were talking to it. What would happen at the other end?
You had your helmet on, you see, and it was all attached here.
Physically in a tube?
It must have been in somewhere or another, yes. Indeed. Yeah. It worked.
You would have to lean down to speak into the speaking tube?
No. That was it. Attached to your flying, your mask.
I see.
Oh, no. You didn't have to do that. No.
And the machine kind of weapon was a Lewis gun?
It would be a Lewis gun of some sort or another, again. It was a machine gun of some sort, yeah.
Which was fairly reliable, but I don't suppose you knew very much about it.
We didn't know much about that, no. The only thing was, of course, made ruddy sure the air gunners, in their enthusiasm, didn't sort of firing at the wrong target half the time, you know.
Or didn't shoot the tail off.
Or didn't shoot the tail of the aeroplane off or something. Mark, it was a fair way back, but even so. But no, it all worked very well. It was a very pleasant 2 months there, really. And, of course, it was all added experience on the swordfish as well, from that angle.
Right, well, I think should we move on to the next?
Right, section? Now, the next stage, I see, I was appointed then to 836 Squadron, where I was to spend the next 2 years of my career.
So this is May 43.
Well, actually, yeah, it would have been the end of May. I finished 25th of May. I did my last flight at St Marin. And we then went up to... I was posted to somewhere, HMS somewhere in Belfast. Never heard of the place before. Nobody knew anything about it at all. And I went over with a met a midshipman. I was a sub-lieutenant at Heysham, you know, where the boats went over to Belfast. And he was destined for the same, but he didn't know any more than I did. We had to report to a place in Belfast, which we did. This chap didn't know anything about it either, other than the fact we were due to go to Londonderry later that day, which we duly did. This chap had a friend in Belfast, his father or uncle or something, and he took us out to dinner, or lunch, I remember, with a few beers there. But we then caught the train, which Londonderry, where we were met by a service utilicant, and taken to a little air station called Maidown, Royal Naval Air Station Maidown. You may have heard of Maidown.
Only because I interviewed Trevor Cannon last week.
Which is near Eglinton, near Eglinton Air Base, really. It was Eglinton was also going at those days as well. And we discovered that, I tell a lie, we went to RAF Ballykelly to begin with, which was just further up the road, where we did a week's ground course. We learnt what 836 was, and Shimmins, in the meantime, had disappeared in another direction. He was going somewhere else, it turned out. But I met Pete Gifford, who's New Zealander. He was waiting there. And we did this. He was coming to 836 as a pilot. We did a week's course on anti-submarine warfare, conducted by the seaman's side of the fish head side, as we'd call them. And you've heard that expression before, fish heads. They were the air branch called the... the seamen fish heads, and the seamen used to call the air branch flyboys. Some mutual hate.
Not airheads.
No. They would have, they thought of it. I exaggerate slightly, but in those days there was a certain amount of feeling between the two sides, actually.
Not real antipathy, but just a sort of...
Well, they thought we were very inferior, and we thought they were all of clowns, so, you know, but apart from that, really, all was well. It gradually dispersed as the years went by. A lot of us trained as seamen officers. I mean, I did a watchkeeping course in the early 50s, so, I mean, I was good steer and destroy and things like that, so the two did melt a bit, yeah.
The anti-submarine course, that sounds quite interesting, because, I mean, we would be in a totally... venture into the new for you. And well, what was your impressions when you heard what you were going to be doing and MAC ships, I suppose?
Well, it sounded... I think, in all honesty, a certain sense of relief that we weren't going out to the Pacific.
Which in 43 was quite a hot number.
Well, it was from then onwards, wasn't it, really, actually? It was indeed. I say relief, I mean, some of those who were death and glory probably were looking forward to it. We weren't, actually. And the Atlantic sounded rather fun, really, to us, you know. All right. Well, you did, in any case, those days, you just did what you were told. I mean, if you'd gone to the Pacific, you'd gone to the Pacific. That would be the end of the matter. Russian convoys weren't very highly thought of, I will say that. But, we did this. It was an intensive anti-submarine course, really. Quite technical.
Can we talk about that? I mean,
well, we can, but I don't know, other than from the flying angle, an awful lot about it, really.
Well, that's what I mean. If we could just briefly talk about how did you look for submarines when you had none of the...
I think it would be better if we did that when we actually get onto the squadron itself and
okay.
We go to sea, I think.
Fair enough.
This was a general course, how the convoy was composed, what it did, the escort vessels, how they got with radar, how they got hold of the submarines, all that sort of thing, which just briefed us up as to... what we were looking at. It wasn't from the airman's angle, it was from a general course, really. And after a week, we then moved to Maidown itself, and this was our 836. And I see here on June the 6th, we did local flying for the first day from Maidown. And then we spent there, now, 836 squadron, now we're coming on to that. Do you think it would be a good idea if we had a break now?
John, whatever you want to do.
I'm just wondering, or whether... Look, I tell you what we'll do. Look, suppose we deal with 836 Squadron, how it was comprised and what it was until the time that B Flight went to sea for the first time in September, which is 2 months, June, July, about 3 months later.
Whatever.
That will be logical. Then it will be a good time to break. Yeah, okay.
Okay.
Now, we would...
Have you met your crew yet? Have you?
No, we haven't got there yet. We'll come to this with this bit now, you see. Now, so we moved over to Maidone now, 836 Squadron. Now, that was the squadron that was due to man all the MAC ships. There were eventually 19 MAC ships altogether, 6 tankers, and Cannon probably told you all this, and 19 grain ships. It's in my article as well, but... we were eventually going to one of those. Now, the first flight of all was A Flight, and they had done an experimental flight in May, I believe, in the McAlpine, which was the very first MAC ship. She was a grain ship. Maybe they did 2 flights, perhaps they did. Now, we were B Flight, and we were the first sort of basically operational permanent flight. A Flight then disbanded, and they rebanded again about a couple of years, or a year later. But so B Flight was the first real routine flight that was formed. Now, a flight would consist of, on grain ships, 4 pilots, 4 observers, 4 air gunners, or actually 4 wireless operators, and 4 swordfish, of course. And it would comprise a lieutenant in charge, 4 sub-lieutenant pilots, 4 sub-lieutenant observers, and 4 leading airmen as the wireless operators. And there would be a petty officer in charge of 16 ground crew who would maintain the airplanes on board the ship.
Four per plane, I suppose, something like that.
Well, you probably 2 per plane, and then you've got armourers and electricians and things. 2 fitters and 2 riggers. 1 fitter, 1 rigger, certainly, per plane. Possibly 1 electrician and... One wireless op, something like that. That was our flight while we were at Maidone, and would go with us, a whole lot would go on board whichever little ship we were going on board. The ground crew would go over usually to Glasgow or to Liverpool, depending on where the ship was going from, and embark a couple of days before we would, and we would fly on directly from Maidone onto the carrier, either in the Clyde or somewhere coming up the ice, see if she was coming from Liverpool. The grain ships had 4 aircraft, and they had a hangar, which was 1 lift, which they used to go in the hangar, and the tankers didn't have a hangar. They had 3 swordfish only. They remained on the flight deck all the time. And those flights, of course, only had 3 pilots and 3 observers and 3 white tops. When you landed on the hangars, of course, it was a bit of a problem. They had a barrier, safety barrier, and the 2 aircraft on board had to be moved ahead while 1 landed on, you see. And then they all had to be moved back again for another one to take off. The grain ships had a hangar but no barrier. So 1 aircraft would land and they had to be struck down first. Then up would come the barrier, then another one would take off. That's how that worked.
So there was a barrier on the grain ships, but it was...
There was a barrier on the grain ships, but not on the tankers. The grain ships had 4 aircraft.
Yes, no, I've got the tankers had 3.
Yeah,
no hangar.
No hangar. So therefore, the aircraft.
But no barrier at all. No safety barrier at all.
I've got this the wrong way around, or we have between us anyway.
Yes, probably me.
No,
but anyway.
The tanker had no barrier. Sorry, I'm getting wrong. The tanker had a safety barrier and 3 aircraft, but no hangar. So when the aircraft landed on, the 2 aircraft had to be ahead of the barrier, and then barrier would be lowered down and they'd all be pushed back again and 1 would take off. The grain ships had no barrier but a hangar. So therefore, 3 aircraft were down below all the time and 1 would land on, put down again, then another one would come up.
But no barrier at all. I mean, that doesn't sound very safe.
Oh, well, you just opened up and went round again. You could do that. Oh, you could do that.
You could on those. I remember you...
Oh, yes, you could on a big fleet carrier, too.
I thought you said that if you missed the last one...
Ah, well, because there would be lots of aircraft parked ahead of you on the big fleet carriers, you see.
I understand. Sorry, yeah, of course.
And that was the object of the safe barrier. Otherwise, I mean, you could go round again. In fact, I think I'm right in saying that when you were doing your initial deck landing practice, there would be nothing on the flight deck at all, and you would be able to go round again. I think. Okay. Anyway, back to the MAC ships now then. So, we've dealt with the hangars and the non-hangars, etc., and the number in the flights. We would, when we embark, now the ground crew, as I said, would embark from either the Clyde or from Liverpool. We would fly on, usually off the Irish coast somewhere. And we would then join our convoy, which would be maybe a day steaming away or something like that. The grain ships with the four aircraft and the tankers, of course, with the three. And with our suitable crew. The ship had a lieutenant commander in charge of it, of the air side and the discipline of the Navy and flying. For the rest of it, though, there was a merchant Navy captain, complete merchant Navy crew, and the captain was in overall command of the ship, with the exception of flying operations. There was some trepidation among the merchant Navy that atmosphere between the two sides, RN and MN, which was notoriously bad in general, in actual fact, it turned out, could not have been more harmonious. We had a wonderful relationship with the merchant Navy. I think they had been selected for not being a crowd of thugs, and which the merchant Navy weren't, but you know what I'm saying, that they, and we got on famously with them, we really did. And I think they were, when they got used to us and their airplanes, they were rather proud of, they were a full-scale merchant ship, this, which would carry about 80% of its cargo, but just had a flight deck built on top. So you've got all the grain in it and all the oil in it, which would unload at either the Clyde or Liverpool.
I didn't know that. I actually thought that...
Oh, no, the whole idea of these grain ships was...
So they were working at the same moment?
They were working merchant ships completely, yeah. You will see that all in this article. You'll see it's all explained in that article I've written, which I'm giving you a copy of. Oh, yes, they'd have all... And, I mean, it would go into Clyde, the grain ship, and would be unloaded. All its grain would come off. And in Halifax, again, we would fly off to Dartmouth, Nova Scotia, for about 8-9 days. Well, the ship would be loaded up with more grain, and in the case of oil, pumped full of oil, and fly, and they're all unloaded at the UK. Oh, yes, that was the big advantage of them. So, anyway, we land. So we join our convoy, and we had a place in the middle of the convoy. Very safe indeed, about four lines on either side of us. We were right behind the Commodore of the convoy, almost at the head, and there was a space completely clear in our line. So for flying operations, we had a big space in the back. This was fine if the wind was roughly from ahead. As you will know, you've got to land into wind, so the ship had to be into wind. Okay, but if it was from astern, we were going right astern, we would probably be out of the convoy and maybe a couple of miles astern before we landed on, which was very important, of course, that everybody landed on as quickly as possible. Otherwise, you're all by yourself in the middle of a hostile Atlantic. And the closing speed between these ships was only about 2 knots between us and the rest of the convoy. Took a couple of hours to get back. And there we were. And off we would go in the middle of the convoy under the orders of the senior officer of escort, who would be in a destroyer or frigate. Usually used to be about 6 escorts around the convoy. Mostly, we would fly a morning patrol and an evening patrol, which would be going round and round the convoy. Just one aeroplane would only be up at any one time. That was known as a cobra, round and round. And we were looking for submarines. The main object was to keep the heads of the submarines down, so they couldn't spot convoys and assemble wolf packs. I don't believe we ever sunk a submarine in the whole war, but they were hugely successful in keeping the heads down, and they did huge work in saving the ships in the convoys. And that's what we would do.
What were the Swordfishers armed with?
We were armed with either depth charges or 8 armour-piercing rockets, not together. So you either fired a rocket from about 800 feet at the submarine. We were told that they would go through a U-boat's pressure hull and out the other side, so it would have been enough to sink even one rocket would have probably sunk a U-boat. Or else depth charges, they, you just, as you know, would have to flow low over the submarine and drop one on either side, which was, of course, a complete death job. They were most unsporting, the U-boats, by this time. They stayed on the surface and fired back. They didn't dive, and you used to get them. And they were very powerfully armed. I mean, they would shot down any swordfish with no doubt at all. The rockets we might have got away with, I don't know. However, we didn't... Well, we are come to that later on, but we used to go round, and it seemed to work. The other type of patrol would be called a mamba, which was when you... If the senior officer escort was in close touch with Liverpool, the headquarters of the anti-submarine stuff, and they, as by that time you may know, had broken into the German codes, and Dönitz's, who was the CEO of the German U-boats in Brest, communicated with all these U-boats, almost every signal he sent was picked up. So Liverpool knew where all the U-boats were and where wolf packs were. And they used to warn the senior escort. Our member was one who would be sent out on instructions of the senior escort to where they thought a U-boat had been spotted or been spotted by radio direction findings. An amusing story I will tell you, that's because it ties up with this. Mid-44s, I think it was, I and my observer and wireless were sent out on a mamba where a U-boat was allegedly on the surface, or had been, about 70 miles away, which is about our maximum range. We used to go up with only three-quarters fuel and with no armament at all in the way of guns to save weight to get off, in order to get off the flight deck. And we got to our maximum range. We passed a frigate steaming at full speed out towards this area as well, which reinforced our belief that there was a U-boat there. And when we got to the very end, North Atlantic, in the middle of the summer, sea for miles, 30 miles more maybe, there was a U-boat, or a submarine, on the surface, in the far distance. So I said to him, so, well, look, we're right in the end of range almost, but we've got to go and attack it if necessary, you know. Last of the heroes, crikey, but this thing armed to the teeth. So we got nearer and nearer and nearer. And I said to them, no, look, we'll go up, son, and come down, son, you see, at it, dive down. And as we got a bit closer, I began to wonder. And when we got a bit closer, we had all had another look, including the observer with his field glasses, and it wasn't a U-boat at all. Incredible story. It was a huge lump of ice, which had broken off a big iceberg, obviously, up in the north of somewhere. We were in the north of the Atlantic anyway. And it was trailing, melting, as though there was a wake coming. There was a great big chunk in the middle which looked like a conning tower with earth all over it. It must have been when it broke away from the U-boat. And a front of it, with again a little sort of melting in the front, which looked like a bow wave. And from a distance it looked exactly like a submarine of some sort. Anyway, of course it wasn't. Thank heavens. So we rapidly about turned and made for the... Me gaily saying, it was fairly calm, the sea, actually. All the age of 21, you know. Well, it's all right, Ken Richardson, the observer, and John Cooper, my air gunner. We'll ditch for that frigate if we run short of fuel, and they'll pick us up, you see. We probably would have done ditched medicine. Swordfish were pretty good at ditching, actually. However, we get to the frigate, which was still going out that way, but... nobody told him or something. I think I got the air gunner to make a Aldous Lamp signal to him if I recall rightly. And I said, we've got enough petrol, I reckon, to get back. So luckily we spotted the convoy straight away. The observer would have his maps out, or rather compass out, you know, sort of thing, telling me what course to steer and that. And there was the convoy. And the ship turned into wind as soon as we were near enough. They obviously realised how short we were of fuel, and we landed on, turned out with about 5 gallons left when we landed on. Mark you, that would have been about 10 minutes flying in the old Swordfish, or thereabouts, you know. But
which would have been, what, about five miles? Or
something like that, yeah. But anyway, it's quite an amusing story, really. That.
And your closest brush with the submarine.
Certainly. Well, we did thought we saw one. Well, we'll come back to the first convoy.
Right, the first convoy then. So this, to get the time right, we're now at the end of...
Let's get me to here. Yeah, right, well, so we're at the first convoy now.
At the end of 43.
No, not quite as early as that. No, earlier than that, rather. Here we are. Well, 1943, August. No, then August, yeah, August. Right, here we are then. Yes, September the 10th, 1943.
Right, okay.
I see from my logbook there's an entry, Maydown, Naval Air Station, to motor vessel Empire McAlpine, the first MacShip. And we joined this off the Irish coast, and this was our first crossing of the Atlantic into Halifax, Nova Scotia, and we came back again some 3 weeks later, going to Liverpool. This convoy was the only one in which, in the 2 years I was with the squadron, we really met some extremely heavy losses in both the escorts and the merchant ships. When we got to Halifax, Nova Scotia, there was a big announcement in the papers there that something like 4 escorts and 8 merchant ships had been sunk in this particular convoy from a wolf pack. I think that was probably an exaggeration. It was probably nearer 2 escorts and 4 merchant ships, but the exact number I'm not quite certain. It might have been certainly not less than that anyway. There was heavy fighting went on. We were on deck one night, I remember, in the mid-Atlantic, when there was a huge explosion ahead of us, and it was the senior officer of the escort ship blowing up, which was a frigate. I think that blew up with no survivors. We also saw a U-boat, whether it was on the surface, trying to surface, or what it was doing, floating down between the lines of the convoy on our starboard side. We were on the flight deck at this stage at about 1 in the morning with our Maywests on, in case the ship had been torpedoed. But of course, being in the middle of the convoy, a Mack ship had a far greater chance of survival than any of the other merchant ships. We also went to bed that night with our wash basin in our cabin, that's my observer and myself, full of paper with a box of matches next to it, so that if the ship was torpedoed and the lights all went out, we would have lit the paper so we could have seen our way out of our cabin.
It was as bad as that. I mean, it was...
Oh, yes.
Everybody was in fear and trembling, really.
Well,
not trembling, but, you know...
No. The position was really serious indeed. I mean, there were about 3 or 4 ships torpedoed that one night. However, we carried on, and we arrived in Halifax, and coming back again, there were no incidents. We used to land... fly off some 60 miles off the coast of Canada, off Nova Scotia or Halifax, and land at the Royal Canadian Air Force Base at Dartmouth, which is some 10 miles out of Halifax. We'd spend about 8 or 9 days there. Our ground crew would come with us, and they would maintain the aircraft. And we were meant to do 1 hour's flying for every day we were ashore. In practice, if we were ashore, say, 8 days, we'd do 8 hours in the first 2 days, and the remaining 6 days we could have a jolly. Hospitality was great, and in all my 11 or 12 double crossings in the 2 years I was with the squadron, we were always invited for a weekend, long weekend, to a Canadian family down somewhere in Nova Scotia, where we were always very well looked after. Really was great stuff. I remember I had my first lobster thermidor in the Royal Nelson Hotel in Halifax. Unbelievable, the food over there these days. And, of course, all the shops and that, really. Liquor was rationed in Halifax. I think it was 1 bottle a month or 2 bottles of it. We always had to get our bottles. The RAF, or Canadian Air Force Station, insisted we got our 2 bottles, and we used to sell them to the wardroom, or to the officer's mess, of course. And we came back again in normal style, and really future convoys from then on till the end of, well, May 43 when I left the squadron, were pretty routine.
Not May 43, May 45.
May 45. I joined the squadron in early May 43, and I left in mid-May 45. I think I'm right in saying I was probably the longest-serving member in the squadron.
Let's go back to the first convoy. I mean, this the business, because Trevor Cannon, I talked to, they said they didn't see or hear a submarine for the whole time. This is obviously you were the,